What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Mike German. As a long-serving FBI agent, German worked undercover in white supremacist and militia groups, developing a deep understanding of their mindsets and strategies. He is now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Previous books include How the FBI Damages Our Democracy and Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, among others. He has a new book out along with Beth Zaslav called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within, where he issues a wake-up call about law enforcement's dangerously lax approach to far-right violence. Good morning, Mike. Thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mike, I want to start with a little context for my listeners about you. You know, I mentioned in the intro that you were an FBI agent at one point. How long were you an FBI agent? Why did you leave? And what is your calling in terms of the work you do around sounding the alarm bell about these dangerous groups?
So I was an FBI agent for 16 years, and to put that in context, that's from 1988 until 2004, shortly after the terrorist attacks on 9/11. I saw the way the FBI was changing. I had worked two domestic terrorism undercover operations and was very familiar with the problems with the FBI's counterterrorism programming. And after 9/11 was asked to go undercover again, and the case was being severely mismanaged. I tried to raise concerns within the FBI about the mismanagement of this case post 9/11, when the FBI was claiming counterterrorism was not its number one priority, and the leaders within the FBI instigated a retaliation program. So I realized that I could either shut my mouth or try to raise these concerns in public. So I went to Congress and reported these issues and realized that that was going to be the end of my FBI career. So I resigned and ended up working at the American Civil Liberties Union, which I thought was the best place to go from the FBI. Because of the threat that the post 9/11 changes were going to have to our civil liberties and privacy. And now I work for the Brennan Center for Justice.
All right. We're going to get into the changes post 9/11, but you said something that sparked another question for me. You know, I grew up as a kid growing up in Las Vegas, in the 80s and the 90s. And what I remember about the 80s and early 90s is that was a time of resurgence of these groups, right, where they were prevalent and active. Can you talk about that what was going on around that time?
Sure. And when you say these groups, I assume you're talking about white supremacists and far-right militant groups, which is
yes,
the subject of my book. Well, so it's always hard because these groups have been around as long as the United States of America has been around. And at various times, supported by the state, supported both nationally and by state and local governments. So judging whether it's increasing or decreasing is always difficult because we don't have a baseline. And you know, even to this day, there's no official counting of the crimes committed by white supremacists and far-right militant groups, including the number of people they kill. What I argue is that these groups are persistent, but you're right. In the time that I was working undercover, you had the incident at Ruby Ridge. You had the Waco incident, which, of course, didn't involve a white supremacist group, but for some reason, white supremacist groups and far-right militant groups had some act or some belief that had something to do with them and took advantage of the crisis to mobilize. So yes, this was a time where these groups were pretty active, and every once in a while even covered in the media, unfortunately often when they committed some heinous crimes. And then of course the Oklahoma City bombing as well.
I mentioned being in Vegas. I remember right? The combat boots and the shaped heads and the red shoelaces and, mm-hmm. and trying to understand what that meant, you know, as a kid. And then once in high school, that invoking some serious levels of fear. The next question is sort of a little bit redundant of what I just asked you, but I would like you to touch on some historical foundation. Like what should the public understand historically for how the white supremacist and militia groups of today were formed and have evolved over time?
I think what is most confusing is the language the government uses to refer to these groups. So they tend to talk about them as extremist groups and lump them into the same categories as what they call animal rights extremists or environmental extremists, where they're fundamentally different because of their relationship to political power. And you have to go back through the history of these groups. And it was fascinating because, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s and spent some time in the South and understood what the Ku Klux Klan was, and kind of thought those were historical artifacts, and that, you know, what I was taught in the FBI is these are extremist groups. So getting prepared to go undercover, being confused about how I would engage with a group that with such extreme beliefs. But what I found was they were, and I presented myself as somebody who was recruitable. So they basically were recruiting me into the group, and they were very literate and had all kinds of books and at that time VHS tapes and newsletters and other material they wanted me to read. And what I found was that historical foundation of these groups is very real to them. That has persisted through time. And, you know, we tend to think that white supremacy is just based on ignorance, but it was the philosophical foundation of colonialism and the European ventures into what became the United States. You know, it supported the African slaves trade, and it wasn't just philosophies, it was religions, it was theological arguments. And those arguments remain and are documented and, you know, are in books. So, you know, they look at the arc of history as they were on top for hundreds of years. And then in the 1960s, there was this bold experiment in civil rights. And that's what's wrong with the country. And we just have to go back to that pre-civil rights Jim Crow era and everything will be fine. So understanding how that history relates to what's going on today, and it's why, pick an event, the January 6th assault on the Capitol in 2021 involved not just members of law enforcement, members of the military, state and local legislators. You know, these people are part of this movement who have political power, and of course, the Trump administration's affiliations with these groups gave them power that the typical quote unquote extremist group doesn't have. You know, they can make a bomb and go out and hurt somebody, but they can't direct policy that hurts lots more people. So when we're trying to figure out how these policies that have persistent racial disparities in who they're impacting, particularly in the criminal justice system, you have to understand that history. And if you want to talk about how to police white supremacist violence, you have to understand how the police are part of the problem, both historically and currently.
Before we go any further, Mike German, I think maybe I should ask this. Is there, and if so, what is the difference between white supremacist and militia groups in thinking, strategy, or composition?
That's a great question, and is something that scholars and academic and advocates debate. And Spencer Sunshine, who has a book out about one particular neo-Nazi group, it gave me terminology for it. He said there are lumpers and splitters, and the white supremacists, as I said, philosophies and theologies create different subgroups. And those subgroups, you know, particularly when they're based on a theological argument, are very rigid and tend not to get along with other groups who have the same political and social goals, but aren't coming from the same theological place. So the groups tend to, it's important to understand how the various groups, and it goes on a spectrum from, you know, direct neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan members to far-right militant groups that claim that they aren't racist. So he's what's called a splitter, or he identifies as a splitter, where for the purposes of policing white supremacy, it's not essential to understand that point in part, and it's better to understand the whole movement. And from a law enforcement perspective, if I have a bunch of people committing violence in public together, the fact that they represent different facets of the white supremacist far-right militant movement isn't really important to me. If they're joined together in a unified effort to commit harm in my community, I want to address them as a movement rather than as, it, you know, argue about their different differences in ideology. And that's really part of the problem with the way the media covers these groups is that they get into a discussion of the ideology, and what the groups understand is that those discussions help them. And, you know, number one, it becomes a very esoteric discussion that's going to appeal to some people. It'll horrify a lot of people, but there will be plenty of people that they know will be intrigued by that and be interested in looking them up and finding out more about them. So that's one of the ways they recruit. So they always want to pivot to a discussion of the ideology and say, oh, you know, we're not Nazis, we're not the Ku Klux Klan, we're this. Where, you know, for the purposes of this book, I would be what Spencer Sunshine calls a lumper, lumping them all together, because I think that's the way police have to understand them in order to address the impact they're having on our democracy.
A practical question to get at something you talk about later on, which is empowering community to defend themselves. Part of that is knowing who they are and how to recognize them. Who are the most prominent or active groups now, and how do they hide in plain sight? What should we know? What should the public know in order to recognize them in our midst?
That's a hard question to answer, the one about the prominent groups, because that changes regularly, particularly when a group is publicly identified with some criminal action. Often what you'll see is the groups will almost immediately disband the group and then reform under a different name, engaging in many of the same activities, including criminal activities, but now saying, oh, we're not that, we're this. And again, that's another way that they confuse the public, but also law enforcement about that, that they can somehow, by changing their logo, put away the criminality of their past and start anew. And unfortunately, law enforcement tends to let them get away with that too often and not really understand how important it is to track the criminal behavior rather than focusing on the ideology. Mm.
Mike German, I think a lot of folks believed before January 6th that these groups are all bark and no bite. But that's not true, right? You mentioned incidents of violence that made the news, you know, like Ruby Ridge or Oklahoma. But some of the stuff gets no reporting at all. Can you paint a picture? I know you said there's no official tracking of the numbers of violent acts that militia and white supremacist groups engage in annually. But can you paint a broad stroke picture about what kind of numbers we're talking about annually?
There are some advocacy groups and academic groups that try to collect this behavior the best they can and document it. And they do a great job. But if you look at them, you'll see that their numbers are wildly disparate. typically won't. It's how these groups are framed, right? Sometimes in the FBI, they'll call them domestic terrorists. They're part, they have a domestic terrorism program that addresses white supremacist violence, sub-program. Although it's not named that anymore. It was when I was working these cases. You also have, if a white supremacist murders somebody, the FBI might call it an act of domestic terrorism. They might call it a hate crime, where they put that in a different category. And terrorism is the counterterrorism is the number one priority for the FBI. Hate crimes are down number five last time they put out a listing of their priorities. So it changes both the resources that are available, but also the nature of the investigation. But oftentimes, white supremacist murders aren't called anything. They're just murders. And, it's the law enforcement agency that's responding to that murder isn't really interested in the ideology of the person who committed the murder. They're interested in solving the murder. And if they have a defendant, they can put that person in prison without ever addressing the ideological justification for that crime. And so a lot of these crimes just disappear. But we're talking dozens of fatalities a year in a typical year. But again, that's based on being identified by law enforcement. Often researchers have to rely on not just court records, but media reports. And what we find is the media will come to this at various times. For example, I started receiving all kinds of calls when Senator Barack Obama said that he would be running for president. And, all these journalists were calling me, white supremacists have to be going crazy about this. It's like, no, you have to understand white supremacists, groups that I worked with, thought every U.S. president has been Jewish and under the control of Israel. This isn't really as big a difference to them as it is to the general public. But what you saw is a lot more interest in reporters going out and collecting information. So they record more of these events. That public attention then brings law enforcement into it, and they now have to respond to the public concern. So they start being more active. So you start seeing these sort of ramp ups that look like, oh, there's a great increase, when it's just a matter of now people are counting. And, some other media event will happen and everybody will turn to a different concern, and the media reporting will drop. And that means the law enforcement interest will drop. So it goes up and down. But it is important to acknowledge that this is a sliver of the violence that affects all of our society, which is, again, another important part, because what we have to recognize is that law enforcement is not very good at solving violent crimes anymore. And that doesn't seem their priority. Half the violent crimes in the United States go unsolved. That includes almost 50% of the murders in recent years. So you can understand how that makes for a more dangerous society.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Mike German. He has a new book out, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. So we've laid all this groundwork for this conversation, and yet this is not, you assert, a priority for the FBI and the mainstream media. And one of the things that I found interesting, that a thread that you tugged on, was the hyper-focus on the Arab world post 9/11. And in what ways has that dampened down reporting or focus on the terrorists that walk among us right here at home?
So the 9/11 attacks, in one manner, increased counterterrorism as a priority. It had not necessarily been the highest priority within the FBI before that. Although it was a high priority, it was just a particularly mismanaged program, as it remains a mismanaged program. But the concerns over white supremacist violence went way down. And in fact, the case I was involved in 2002 involved an effort by supporters of a Middle Eastern terrorist group to recruit white supremacists to work for them based on the shared hatred of Jews. But that didn't fit in the model that most people in the FBI viewed this problem. And I think that was part of the reason why there wasn't an interest in making sure that case was handled properly. And you know, if you look at the enforcement after 9/11, so many resources went into investigating the Muslim American communities writ large, mass surveillance programs that scooped up all of our metadata from our cell phones and telephones, these mass surveillance programs that were really going to do very little to understand the small number of people who engage in that activity. You know, we're a very fortunate country that we don't really suffer from a lot of terrorism. So rather than trying to focus all the resources on the known actors who are involved in this kind of criminal activity, we looked at everybody as a potential suspect, hoping that we would somehow be able to discern through some algorithm or now artificial intelligence who was going to commit a serious crime in the future. And I continue to argue that that's a wrong approach to addressing this problem, and that if we instead focus on the people who are committing crimes, we make for a more safer society.
Mike German, I want to start to deconstruct a bit some of the reasons why perhaps there is not a more proactive or even active dealing with the internal threat of these groups by the FBI. Can you talk a bit about the affinity law enforcement has with these groups? And you've already mentioned, you know, on the flip side, the animosity they have for groups on the other side who fight for social justice. You left off one of the extremist groups that they focus on, and that was the Black Identity extremists, which I think was the first conversation that I had with you.
Right. You know, white supremacy is not just a problem in law enforcement, it's a problem in our society. And so law enforcement and the military and other entities recruit from our society. So there's going to be a portion of these institutions that are devoted to a dangerous ideology. That it's an ideology that for many is familiar. You know, number one, you have institutions like the FBI that has a white supremacist history. You know, the institution itself was very focused on groups based on their efforts to agitate for racial and social justice. So the FBI was almost entirely, the special agent cadre was almost entirely white. There were only a handful of non-white agents and no women for many years. So after J. Edgar Hoover died, every FBI director since then has publicly stated that diversifying the FBI is a priority and essential to effective law enforcement and protecting our national security. And yet the FBI remains a predominantly white male special agent cadre. And part of that creates a bias in who presents a threat. You know, when you're no longer focused on who's committed a crime and how do I prove that crime, and instead focused on who might be a threat in the future, you know, we know from social science that people are more comfortable with things that are familiar and more afraid of things that are unfamiliar. So if you have, you know, close to 80% of the agent corps white males, that makes it very easy for them to look at somebody who might have white supremacist ideas and say, well, that person's not really a threat because I know somebody who has those ideas. You know, I go to Thanksgiving and my uncle says these things and he's no threat. You know, he's not somebody who could ever hurt anybody. So I don't see these ideas as dangerous. Whereas somebody who's, you know, coming from a different ideology would be seen as, well, that's threatening. That threatens my social status, like the political system that I'm sworn to protect. So I'm going to see that advocacy as a threat rather than focusing on whether that advocacy is engaged in in violence, or those advocates are engaged in violence. So, you know, it just creates, you know, the predominance creates a basis for what's often called unconscious bias. I dissect that term, you know, up through the Jim Crow era, the bias was written into the law. It was part of what law enforcement officials were enforcing, were the racial caste system that existed in law. And after the civil rights movement, the law changed. So when we see these harsh racial disparities in the criminal justice system, from who gets stopped to who gets searched to who gets arrested, to how they get charged to how long they get sentenced, disparities in every one of those categories, there became some study around how is this possible once we don't have, you know, we have equality in the law. And so this concept of unconscious bias came out, that this was an institutional problem or a structural problem or an individual implicit bias problem, where that may have been true immediately, but by now we've measured how this bias has an impact. So it's no longer unconscious. It's conscious. We recognize the bias exists and we're not doing anything to stop it. So that to me is no longer an unconscious bias. That is something that that we need to accept and deal with. And, you know, implicit bias training has become part of law enforcement training to teach people how they might, even though they feel like they aren't biased against any particular race or religion, they may be in the way that they act. But I quoted three different implicit bias trainers who said that when they talk to law enforcement audiences, they never raise explicit bias as an issue. And the police officers and agents in the room know that they have colleagues who are racist. And so pretending that it's not explicit kind of undermines the whole point of the training. And the failure to acknowledge that this is a real thing. And, you know, part of the reason I started writing about this issue is that in the FBI in the 1990s, when I was being prepared to go undercover, we had a joint terrorism task force that involved a number of state and local, other federal state and local agencies. And they were very explicit with us that, hey, you know, there are sympathizers to these white supremacist groups in law enforcement. So when you all go back to your department, don't talk about this case. You know, this could get Mike hurt. So, you know, be very careful with who you share information about this case with. And that was seen as a wise warning, right? Nobody was disputing that. And then later, after I was at the ACLU, a Freedom of Information Act revealed an internal FBI document that basically gave that same warning to FBI agents. This was an internal document warning that white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement was a problem that affected their cases and that they had to be careful about it. In 2015, another internal document, the FBI's Counterterrorism Policy Guide, leaked. And it was very explicit. It said, FBI agents working domestic terrorism cases against white supremacists and far-right militant groups have to be careful because the subjects of those investigations often have active links to law enforcement. And this internal recognition of a problem that they deny in public is astonishing. And in 2020, in October of 2020, I was asked to testify before Congress on this issue. And the FBI was also asked to testify and to update its 2006 and 2015 information. And they disavowed that intelligence, disavowed intelligence that had been collected by their own agents and analysts, and said it wasn't a problem. That was 3 months before the attack on the Capitol that involved police officers engaging in criminal activity. So, you know, that denial, I think, is a huge part of why this problem persists.
You're listening to Law & Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Mike German. He has a new book out, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Mike, those of us who follow these threads know that once Trump launched his first campaign in 2015, it emboldened these people to, as I put it, slither out from underneath their rocks and become more active. What did that look like? And then throughout the Trump presidency, what did the dance between Trump and these groups look like?
So, some remarks that then candidate Donald Trump made appeared on their face to be racist, and that encouraged these groups to be more public. And, you know, frankly, the part of the problem was the media, that the media started reaching out to people within these groups to get their viewpoint on a presidential election, which elevated their status within these groups. But they started coming out and committing violence in public because they had this feeling that this type of activity was now authorized, that the government would allow it. And in fact, in many cases, the police did allow it to occur. And of course, that then allowed them to build more networks to get to know different groups, as we were talking about earlier, you know, lumping the groups together that, okay, we might not agree on specific philosophies or theologies, but we agree this is an opportunity for us both to go out and engage. So we're going to work together. And we saw that at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017, where the groups all came together, and unfortunately, law enforcement allowed them to commit violence and walk away without being arrested. And that was just a green light for these groups to start doing that all over the country, which is what we saw. And not too many people, and the media really wasn't following how these groups were traveling around the country. But I assumed that the FBI would be, right? Usually when you have group activity that involves criminal activity and crossing state lines, that gets the FBI's attention. But they didn't engage, and these groups became more and more powerful, and their ability to travel cross country and network with each other and build logistics and move people from one place to another increased until what we saw at the Capitol on January 6th, where they had thousands of people gathered. You know, more than 1,000, arguably, or what the government later said was about 2,500 who were willing to commit crimes, and particularly violent crimes, in order to prevent congressional procedures to elect a new president. So that kind of power is very different than what we see in these other groups that the FBI considers domestic violent extremists, but don't engage in that kind of violent activity, and certainly not deadly activity. Yet the FBI tends to prioritize those groups, as you mentioned, the Black Identity Extremists, which was a category they invented out of whole cloth.
At the time of this interview, we are less than a week away from the beginning of a second Trump presidency. From your perch, what are you most concerned about given his relationships with these kinds of groups?
I'm of course, very concerned about what people with these sympathies in government can do, right? A government policy can do far more harm to far more people than a violent extremist group. So that's certainly the top of my concerns. As far as the groups themselves, I don't think there's enough recognition that these groups aren't natural Trump supporters. And to the extent he was manipulating them, they were also manipulating him. And it was kind of a mutual agreement, but they're expecting a certain outcome that many of them are going to feel dissatisfied by. So, you know, to the extent we start seeing more anti-government, even during a Trump administration, violence, I think you are going to see that. You know, I'm concerned that unfortunately, since January 6, 2021, the government has not done enough to address white supremacy affinity for these groups in law enforcement. That's true of the military as well. You might remember that right after the events, that there was a new policy put in place and some instruction, but later reporting showed that, those policies weren't being followed. Department of Homeland Security brought together a commission to study the issue within the Department of Homeland Security, but disbanded after discovering that they couldn't, or reporting that they couldn't determine what domestic violent extremism was, even though that's the justification for many of their surveillance and intelligence programs. And the FBI and Justice Department, again, that included some people who actually participated in criminal activities, didn't do anything. There was no effort to address the problem within the FBI. I'm concerned that that you're going to have issues within law enforcement. I think people could misconstrue that there were FBI agents who participated in the violence, not you know, the right wing conspiracy that they were undercover agents and all that, but rather there were former FBI employees who were charged with crimes. I think there were two at least. Their participation was a minor problem. The failure to prepare for an attack that was planned in plain sight has still not been explored by government. This was something anyone who followed these groups knew that there was going to be a big gathering of violent people who had committed violence in the past at the Capitol that day. The Hotel Harrington closed, right? A hotel that had been the locus for some of the activity just said, we're just going to close that day. So how does the Hotel Harrington have a better idea of what's going to happen that day than the FBI, and how they were not able to see something, particularly because although they said there was no intelligence about the potential for violence, what we later found out through some investigation was there was quite a bit of intelligence that FBI analysts and agents were reporting. But as I said about the hearing prior to January 6th, they don't want to see what their own agents are reporting to them, the FBI managers. So, I'm concerned that they still don't see this as a threat and still aren't doing anything to address the issue within these agencies.
So I would say that's one call to action, that they need to address the issue inside of the agencies. Mm-hmm. What else? What tools do we already have and what do we need to push for?
So within law enforcement and for law enforcement leaders, and I know that they're, the vast majority of law enforcement doesn't agree with these groups and isn't interested in affiliating with them and are upset by the tolerance for racism within their agencies. But when you talk to law enforcement leaders about this, they often kind of throw up their hands and say, we can't monitor what's inside the head of a police officer or an agent. We can't monitor their social media constantly. We can't do this stuff. And what I tell them is you don't have to do any of that. That won't be helpful. What you need to do is focus on behavior. And you have all kinds of tools to do that, mainly your own officers, because the officers know who the racist cops are. And they will tell you if you tell them to, and you protect them, and you reward them when they do. Right now, and this has been a problem for decades, that it's more dangerous to report racist misconduct by a colleague in law enforcement than it is to engage in racist misconduct. So that's a big part of the problem. But also the community knows. It's fascinating to me how when the community makes a complaint, too often we have law enforcement agencies defending somebody who has a long history of this behavior, rather than seeing that as an opportunity and supporting the community rather than the officer that's harming the community. And finally, they have discrimination complaints within the agencies. So you know, there you have two officers, right? Two of your employees. One is saying that the other has discriminated against them because of their race or gender or ethnicity. And the institutional prerogative is to defend the person who's been accused rather than support the person who's been impacted. So there's all kinds of information out there that could be collected and that could be used to identify the problem officers. Because if there's an officer who secretly holds racist beliefs, but you would never know that by their public behavior or official activities, I think that person is far down the list of who you have to worry about. And there might be somebody who believes that they're not racist at all, but their activity suggests that they're engaged in misconduct and impacts particular communities, then that needs to be addressed.
You talk about one tool being to not expand the power of law enforcement, but rather to empower the most impacted communities to defend themselves, their neighborhoods, their lives. What does that look like in practice?
So that's a great question because, you know, after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017, there were a lot of people in the public calling for the police to do more to address this concern. And law enforcement, particularly federal law enforcement, was saying, oh, you know, give us more tools, give us more power. But what I argue and what I demonstrate in the book and an earlier report is that they have plenty of tools. They have all the tools that are necessary. They choose not to use them targeting these groups and instead use them to target groups that aren't engaged in the same kind of deadly violence. So it's not a matter of empowering them to do more harm. In fact, what we have to do is hold them accountable and ensure that as citizens, we are making complaints, not just to the police department so that they have an official record, but to your local representatives, to your federal representatives, and make sure they know this is a priority. And then the other part is protecting community. You know, so much of the white supremacist violence is designed to put particular communities in fear and make them feel disconnected from the rest of society. So in response to any kind of hate crime or racist violence, it's very important to engage that community, to make sure that community knows that they're part of a broader community and will receive those kinds of aid and protection. And, you know, to the extent that a hate crime becomes something that brings more resources and opportunities to the targeted community, that's a good outcome because it would dissuade the violent behavior in the first place. If these groups start to learn that if we can do that kind of activity, these groups will receive benefits that will dissuade them from doing that. So it's holding the police accountable, but also making sure that community is protecting community. And where the police aren't following the law and aren't following up on this, making sure that the communities have the resources so that they can protect themselves.
Family, you've been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been Mike German. As a long-serving FBI agent, German worked undercover in white supremacist and militia groups, developing a deep understanding of their mindsets and strategies. He is now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Previous books include How the FBI Damages Our Democracy and Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, among others. The book we've been discussing today is his new one that is out along with Beth Zasloff, called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within, where he issues a wake-up call about law enforcement's dangerously lax approach to far-right violence. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fortnox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.